The time is April 26, 1991, when Sylvester Stallone takes off his boxing gloves and bloodstained t-shirts in an attempt at comedy, where he teams up with well-known comedic director John Landis to play Angelo Snaps Provolone, who is a gangster in the early 1930s who makes a promise to his dying father, played by Kirk Douglas, that he will give up his life of crime and go straight. In an attempt to live a life of honesty away from crime, the rest of his house has other plans. That's not going to make it easy for Snaps. From a lying and stealing accountant, a house full of gangsters, a fake daughter, a privileged daughter, a fake pregnancy, to a priest and a speech therapist, all of which seem to intertwine to one big punchline to a joke. This week on Back to the Balcony, we cover this 1991 chaotic comedy and the reviews that followed for Oscar.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony.
So, first reactions to this one, first introduction. This one I think I saw when I was about 10 years old, and I believe it was on Showtime at the time. And being 10 years old, this had no appeal to a 10-year-old. There was only one thing for me that screamed in this movie for my inner child to watch, and that, of course, is Sylvester Stallone. And seeing him in a comedic role, I remember watching this from start to finish. And right when the characters are introduced, it grabbed my attention. This movie had a childlike appeal to really draw me in. And after my viewing, I remember flipping through the TV guide, wondering when this was going to be on again to record it on VHS. And I swear I had to have worn out this VHS tape over the last 2 years after recording. This one was one of my 90s go-tos when it comes to just what made me fall in love with the chaotic comedy. And I know, Antonio, me and you have had conversations, and you know I love a chaotic comedy. I love these nods to the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and kind of that character-driven slapstick. So, I mean, I've been dying, and I've been holding myself back from texting hints or what we normally do, because I really want to see your first reaction to this.
Well, I mean, so yeah, I was 10 years old when I saw it too, but I actually saw it in the theater with my mom because A, she was a huge Sylvester Stallone fan, but also she was a very big fan and supporter of not only slapstick and chaotic comedy like you talk about, but she loved the kind of farcical comedy that you would see in a lot of like British productions, you know, where doors are always opening and shutting and people going in and out. Just the year before this came out, the Bogdanovich version of Noise is Off came out. And that is like the perfect example of what I'm talking about. It's farce. It's characters in and out. And my honest opinion about this movie, and I'll go ahead and throw it out there, I love it. I loved it then. I love it now. But I was already tempered in that style of comedy. I grew up with the Neil Simon comedies. I grew up with the slapstick and the Frank Capra and the Howard Hawks, you know, stuff from the 30s and 40s too. So I think my brain was already prepared for what kind of comedy this was going to be, as was she. Like, she loved it too. But when you go and you read some of people's reviews, either on Letterboxd or on IMDb, about how they just don't understand why people think this is funny, I think you have to be introduced to this kind of comedy early. You have to understand what they're doing and what they're paying homage to. And we say that all the time with these, you know, discussions that we have. And what I can honestly say about this movie is that it doesn't matter who is playing the main character. It doesn't matter who's playing Snaps. The fact that Sylvester Stallone is a great way to get people into the theater, but like all farce and like all slapstick comedy, It's all about the supporting characters, the side characters, and the way the action is handled that makes something like this work. And when we get to the reviews of our critics, they have a very good point that they make about this that hit it right on the nose. And that is, you can have a film start off kind of sluggish, maybe not convince you, but if it can win you over in the second and the third act with its action and its characters, well, then it's just that much more impressive that not only was it able to pull itself up from its bootstraps, so to speak, but give you a lot of fun and a lot of memorable moments in the film to put it in your wheelhouse forever. And I think that's where you and I both fall into place, is that this is so full of character, so full of great dialogue and snappy moments, that it doesn't matter how wooden or how weak the main character actually is, because it's the rest of the cast that brings it together.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up Noises Off, because we saw that from the Michael Caine character too. He has that kind of that serious note to it. And back in the 90s, we didn't have, this wasn't a common comedy. This wasn't a raunchy teen comedy. This wasn't a family affair where you have, like, again, those silly farce jokes. This was a character-driven, dialogue-driven comedy. And there wasn't a lot of studios investing a lot of money or a lot of time or a lot of risk to these movies. So there's a lot of appreciation when we have Noises Off and then comes Oscar. So when it comes to the audience reaction, people want to feel that laugh out loud belly laugh. And that's not what this movie is. It's an innocent comedy and it's witty. And that's what people are missing about this type of comedy, is it's not supposed to be walking into a theater, hearing the audience roar with laughter, but is it smart? Is it character driven? Is it something that sticks with you with the written dialogue or the comedic lines? And this has a lot of great lines to it that really does stay with me, even though it's not full belly laughs. So I think there is a lot to this movie that people and critics at that time really did miss the mark. And when it comes to, you're 100% right, is it doesn't matter who the main character is, because that character is just the footing there to actually support the supporting characters. And this is a perfect casting. I know we'll get into it with the reviews, but our critics do speak to it, and that will be my one disagreement to it. But I think Stallone does a fantastic job playing that character. And I know in the 80s, they had a rough draft where Belushi was in talks to play this role. And that would have been a completely different movie. But I think the casting choice with Stallone was actually a pretty smart move.
Well, it's a smart move, but it makes me wonder, like, why that decision was actually made, because Stallone did not have a good track record with comedies up to this point. You know, he had Rhinestone in the early 80s with Dolly Parton. It's a cult favorite, but not considered a great movie. And then just the utter disaster that was Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, which apparently, if the apocryphal story is true, the only reason why he took that role is because Schwarzenegger convinced him that he was doing another kind of spoofy comedy at the same time. And so Stallone, always in competition with Schwarzenegger, jumped into that project, even though he really didn't want to do it. He just didn't want to be one-upped, and hence that movie exists. Again, that might be apocryphal, but it's a great story. So this is a weird time for Stallone to do a film like this, because he really is kind of riding high on his early 90s wave of success. Just did Rocky V. Cliffhanger is coming out around the same time as this. And then he's got his, you know, 1-2 punch of Demolition Man and then Into the Specialist. Like, he's got his action movies all lined up. So to do a character-driven farcical comedy right in the middle of that, it's an interesting choice. And it's an interesting choice, too, that John Landis is chosen to direct this, because he was kind of in Hollywood jail at the time, right? His last big hit was Coming to America in 1987, and then he was just kind of wading through projects to get to this. And nothing about this concept says box office, right? It's a 1930s prohibition, farcical, slapstick comedy. It's a remake of a French play, which we just kind of figured that out recently, which I didn't have a chance to see, but I'm dying to see it. And it's character driven. It feels like something that should be like a stage play or something that was maybe run on Broadway or off Broadway first before brought to the screen, because no one really knows what it is. No one knew what Oscar, the French film, was. So it's a hard sell. It did, you know, kind of affect it at the box office, but I have to respect the bravery of the studio that produced it, of John Landis, who directed it, and then the cast they put together, because it's a hodgepodge of well-known and respected B-movie or character actors, a lot of up-and-comers, and then Stallone. Like, Stallone's the only real name to this. We can watch it now and name off all of the people that we see and be like, oh my God, I can't believe that Harry Shearer's in this or Chaz Palminteri's in this. But back then, man, they were still like kind of earning their street cred and stripes. So again, this is really kind of an obscurity to me of how it got made, how it got such an amazing cast, and how it didn't just collapse under its own weight, which it really could have done having been handled any other way than the way it was.
This is a perfect example of it's so crazy it works with studios. And I love stories yeah. like this, because I think the appeal, why going back to why I think Stallone was a smart move, because it's the same concept of dressing the football player up as a cheerleader. He's out of his element, but it's a good medium where he is still that tough guy dressed up in a suit. He has to play that tough guy, stereotypical gangster that wants to change. And just like him and his acting style, he has to change his acting style with it as well. So they're both at a tug of war when it comes to how they're attacking this portrayal of Snaps Provolone. So I think Stallone is really learning his role, and the dialogue is really going to help. The Penn screenplay is really going to help with this, because this is one of those screenplays that is just a blueprint. You do not know what you're going to get until you get that supporting cast right there interacting with each other. There's a lot of improv that probably went into this on how the lines are delivered. And you can tell in certain scenes that they are literally bouncing off of each other and they're feeling that energy. And it's a magic moment when you see Stallone really start to interact with it. And we can feel the progression where it takes him a little bit to warm up to it. And we see that from the first 5 minutes of the movie going into even all the way up to Dr. Pool, where that's the pivotal moment where we feel him start to really feel comfortable in the chaos. So to me, I think it's a learning curve. And I think that's part of the magic of this character driven, is these characters and these performances are really driving this story and how the outcome and the character development is really going to play out in the climax. So we're learning as an audience and a viewer along with Stallone. So, and I think that's part of what makes this movie so fun, is because it engages with us and we're going along for the ride.
Yeah, it takes a very special kind of mind to appreciate this and catch all the things on first viewing, because it's very fast and there are a lot of props and set pieces and interchanges that happen so quickly, it's really easy to miss. So just to kind of like make an example, I feel Clue, you know, from 84, 85, was a good testing ground, proving ground of how this concept could work for an American audience, where you got an ensemble cast and you are literally fooling them and tricking them and doing the whodunits and where is the suitcase and where is the evidence and where is the hammer and where's the gun, that kind of stuff, keeping audiences on their toes. It takes a very special kind of film watcher to catch everything on the first go around. And that's why the rewatchability factor of this is so high, is because you are expecting when the suitcase gets switched. And it's almost like a three-card Monty game. Will I be able to catch where that switch was? Will I be able to maybe catch the production in a mistake and not really follow through and have inconsistencies with the structure of the story or the action? That's why I love movies like this. It's why Clue has such a high rewatchability factor. Once you watch it all the way through, you can watch it again and see, oh, did I miss this? Did I miss this? Did I miss this? And this is the perfect example of that. But the hard part about this one, too, and I think why it struggles to find a more contemporary audience, is that it's not very easily accessible for some. Like, it's been on and off streaming. I had to find it on YouTube because I could not find my old VHS copy. I've never had a DVD of this. I aim to remedy that. But because it wasn't such a great hit afterwards, it really didn't play a whole lot. Like you just said, you had to check the TV guide to find out when it was playing again on cable or when it was playing again on Showtime. That is one of the struggles with movies from the 80s and 90s, where if it didn't find a theatrical audience and it didn't find a huge market in home video, it kind of lost its path. And this is one of those movies where I feel it lost its path, and I'm glad we're talking about it.
This is one of those movies that really does make me a little bit sad when it comes to current films, because we don't see movies like this anymore. And even, like I said earlier, this was rare for the 90s, and it's got almost the last of its kind if you take out like Big Night and some rarities, right?
Right.
And as I revisit this movie, it almost is a shame that we don't see movies like this anymore, because more readily available, as you said, because this, I think, in current times with how movies are so bloated, so CGI filled that we've talked numerous times before, this would be a big piece of that cinematic reset that we get if it's just introduced again. It would encourage those viewers to seek out movies like this, because we don't have smart dialogue like this. We don't have smart comedy anymore. We rarely have comedy as is hit theaters. So this movie is more important than what people actually realize. And this is a movie that people should seek out to see to really encourage a lot of these early screenwriters to really pay attention to the detail. This is a movie, if you are an early screenwriter or if you're in film school, that I would say watch along with some other chaotic comedies to really show an example of detailed skill writing that really takes its time at a fast pace to really pay attention to our characters and really pay attention, not necessarily to character development, but the actions of our characters and character placement. This movie is one of those that really needs to be seen when it comes to writing nowadays.
Well, yeah, I agree with you on the writing part, but that doesn't work unless you have a cast that can pull it off and a director that can handle that kind of chaos. John Landis really is the perfect kind of guy for this, because having people bring energy to the film, but also have a restraint with the story and dialogue is kind of his specialty. I mean, this is a guy that was able to really like kind of like channel the energy of actors like Belushi and Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy. You know, being able to get that really nuanced and restrained performance out of Eddie Murphy for Coming to America, I don't think people realize how difficult that actually is for him. Watch any other Eddie Murphy movie from the 80s, or especially the mid to late 90s, where he's playing 10 different people. You can tell that there is a restraint and that there is a control over the actor. And that is very evident in this, because these characters could be loud and obnoxious and big, and the biggest energy comes from Stallone himself. But Stallone's so low energy to begin with, his big energy actually mediates everyone else's energy to work with. So when you talk about like the Fanucci brothers or Kurtwood Smith as a lieutenant, all these great character actors who are known for chewing scenery, they're given carte blanche to chew the scenery because it's essentially theirs to chew as long as Stallone does what he's supposed to do and not be too Stallone, right? That's the fine balance that Landis really lands perfectly. And this is the fact that this cast of character actors from the 70s, from the 80s, from TV, from the old days, it may be the best moments of their careers in this film, because they were allowed to be exactly how they wanted to be, where they weren't just, oh, I'm going to be the angry captain of the police force. You know, Art LaFleur playing comedy in this instead of playing the pissed off police captain. Kurtwood Smith being the goofy lieutenant instead of being the villain of a film. Chaz Palminteri being literally the dummy of the group when normally he's the cool and calculated detective or mob guy. It's almost like casting against type with a purpose, and it works. It lets these actors act, and it's not typecasting them to what we recognize them in most of the movies. It's letting them play, and that's what makes this movie so much fun, is that they're playing. the fact that Tim Curry might be the second most restrained person in this film even proves that point more so.
Well, you're right about Landis. I mean, his character direction is always on par. So he really knows how to challenge his characters. But I will say what I'm really, as I rewatch it, especially the last couple of weeks, what really took me by surprise is how he does capture, and you spoke to it earlier, the almost play feel, the it feels like watching a live stage chaotic play. So that to me is something that almost challenges Landis, because we don't see that from his previous works per se. We see it in his characters, and we see that in how he shoots his characters. But when it comes to actionables of people coming in and out, comedic timing with these subtle forces, this is a little bit out of Landis's wheelhouse. And I have to say, this is an impressive feat for me to see Landis in this element, because to the most challenging piece of a movie like this, and again, we spoke to Noises Off, they did the same thing, but that was a play within a play. This is a little bit more challenging, where you have to really capture that feel. And I can't go without mentioning the fantastic music that really integrates that to really bring that feel. I mean, Elmer Bernstein helped compose a lot of this music to it. And what I really loved is that they really kept that Barbara Seville kind of feel, and almost the storyline only flipped it a little bit. And the way Landis really captures all these elements to get that feel and to support our characters is spot on to mere perfection.
I think one of the things that some people might not like about this movie, if they don't know what it is or if they don't know what the concept and energy is the fact that it's not necessarily the lines of dialogue that are funny. It is the way that they are performed. It is the way that they are enhanced by the energy of the actors. It's a great pitter-patter dialogue, but is it a great story? Is it a great script? You and I had a debate about clichéisms in our Seems Like Old Times episode, where, you know, I was saying it's really paying homage to the slapstick comedies of the day, but does that translate well into a modern setting? What's really impressive about this is that this was based on a French play that was set in the contemporary time when it came out, late 60s. And instead of a gangster, it was a French businessman. So being able to take that structure and do what I said Seems Like Old Time should have done and put it in the past and change it up. So now it's 1930s. And instead of a businessman, it's a mobster trying to go legit. And his daughter's situations where, you know, she's in love with the chauffeur who we don't meet till the end, like all that kind of fun stuff. It, again, convinces me that this is a rarity that they made that work, that they retrofitted something that was probably paying homage to slapstick and farce of the 30s anyway, and took it back to the time where it actually probably fit the best with the characters that fit the best. And that music, the operatic stuff, and even the fun cameo from Kirk Douglas in this overly hammy Italian performance. Again, the way this film impresses me of what it does, you can just throw all those negative critiques and reviews away, because I know how difficult it was to make this work. And again, my opinion is box office never means anything about quality or the life expectancy of a film. It's all about how it's discovered, how it's re-examined and reassessed. And we're doing it right now. I hadn't watched this movie in like a decade, and I've always loved it. And I think because you and I've had these conversations of films like Seems Like Old Times and other stuff like that, it makes me appreciate even more, because now I've actually gotten that discourse out. And my mind's like focused on what to look for. And this movie was just so full of that stuff that we talk about all the time.
Yeah. And when we look at Seems Like Old Times, I think the one thing we agreed on is that Under the Direction is kind of was the main misfire. Here we have writers Michael Berry and Jim Mullahan, who have almost that same kind of background of television, sitcom-y TV with Mary Tyler Moore, Joan Rivers. They have that old style comedy. They have that experience of that writing, and we see a lot of that snappiness. And again, with Seems Like Old Times, there's potential there that we saw with some of those lines. I just think the delivery and the direction was pretty bad. Here we have that experience. We have a great comedic director. We have an experienced couple of writers that have source material to base the feel from. There are all these elements that really we can compare the two movies to. But here, the execution is on par with every shot, every scene. It's pre-planned. And there's a vision that we can tell from the adaption that we get from page 10 all the way up to the climax of where this movie wants to go. It's almost, you can almost hear Landis go, aha, I know what I want to do with this. And it's a team effort between every technicality, from the music to the editor to the writers being involved in it. So this is, again, one of those perfect examples where we have all the entire production team involved in how this movie's going to work. It's all about leadership when it comes to who's leading the pact, who's on set.
So my question for you is, though, how does this become a bomb and Seems Like Old Times becomes a hit? Like, in the court of public opinion, this movie's terrible and Seems Like Old Times is great. I never said it was a great movie. I said it was fun and I like it. Those are two different things. Yet here's a movie that we're both just ranting and raving about how much we like it and how underappreciated it is. Where does that underappreciation stem from? We have two critics that applauded it, which we'll get to in a few minutes. And from what we've discussed in the previous 11, 12 episodes that we've done, is that is the critic's job, right? To go in and give you like a baseline reading of what this film is, and is it worth your time, and is it worth your money? And they 100% said yes. So how is this one of the biggest flops of the 90s and Seems Like Old Times is one of the biggest hits of the 80s? Like, help me through that, through your point of view.
My point of view is, one, timing's everything, and marketing is secondary to that, because we early 90s, we have the surrounding movies that followed this movie. I mean, this came out in the tail end of springtime. We have the trailer that wasn't even a great trailer, but we also look at the time era here. So if we look at movies like Harlem Nights, Newsies, a lot of these 30s, 40s movies that historically these movies didn't do well at all. And a lot of these gangster movies, and I know Ebert will speak to it later in our show, but the interest, I think, for the time era really wasn't there. And it's, what was the target audience? Was it was rated PG. So was it for kids? Was it for adults? There was a big question mark in that time of who this movie was made for. And like I said, as a 10-year-old, that era didn't interest me. So there's no way, if my parents took me to this movie, I would be excited to go. I'd want to see Sylvester Stallone. That would be my thing. But there is a lot of elements, and you spoke to it earlier, is we have the Sylvester Stallone piece of it, but we don't have that chaotic humor. We have the 80s comedy. We have the dirty comedy. We have the family comedy, but little in between. So, and the early 90s was even more so for that. So I think the marketing had trouble targeting who this was for, because if I just watched the trailer today, I really wouldn't be interested too much in it. So this one, I think, was kind of a failed marketing mission, and it's just reviews and the critic reactions audience reactions following that, of them not being ready for a movie like this. I shouldn't say ready for a movie like this. I'd say they didn't want a movie like this, or seeing Stallone in a comedy, really kind of gave this movie a bad word of mouth, and it was just the domino effect.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, also, this is the same year as Terminator 2. You know, we're building franchises and blockbusters this same year. Is a film like this really the Stallone film that people want to see? It's funny how they don't do that kind of stunt casting as much anymore, because they don't have to. Like, they can really just reset a franchise with a new cast. As long as it follows the certain expectations that audiences have told the studios they want to see. Special effects, world building, fanboy culture being involved, or fangirl culture. So I think, you know, if we look into the DNA of this, we're seeing studio execs with a maybe glimmer in their eye of a genre they used to enjoy and hoping that they could bring back and maybe make the public excited for it if they have a name like Stallone in it, right? And all the other great people in this cast. So while it is a box office failure and a critical failure in many aspects, I still think that it's a fantastic movie, overlooked, underappreciated, desperately needs a resurgence in the zeitgeist. And also, I mean, think about it. The biggest star in this movie nowadays is probably Marissa Tomei, you know, and she's great. It's a very early role for her, and she has a huge fan base right now, too. So if you're trying to go back and look at her older works before My Cousin Vinny, before the Oscar, look at stuff like this, where she plays it perfectly. I want to see her play Stallone's daughter again. Like, their chemistry actually works really well, and I think it works well because it really doesn't work. But that's the way it's supposed to be, right? For the movie, it works well. She overpowers him in every scene. But that character is supposed to be overpowering of her dad. That's why she gets away with so much stuff. That's why he creates all of these false circumstances to get her married off, right? It's that depth of these characters and the depth of that writing that maybe these are happy accidents with the chemistry and the casting, or it was perfectly coordinated. I couldn't tell you either, but it just works. And that's like my final closing statement on Oscar.
And it does work. Marissa Tomei does a fantastic job, and the chemistry is there. And when we look at it, it's a really impressive feat because this is early Marissa Tomei. And the dynamic between Sylvester Stallone and Marissa Tomei, it's a father-daughter, privileged kid with rich dad kind of relationship. And, you know, the Landis knows what he's doing with it because we get that symbolic wink from Marissa Tomei to Stallone at the end where he gives that speech, pick a fiance, you're on your third one before noon. And she gives that little sweet wink to her dad. So it's one of those, she's a spoiled brat, but we just love watching the dynamic on screen. So I think the chemistry is there between them. And you're right, Marissa Tomei, this is probably one of the most recognizable origin stories from any of the cast that we have in Oscar. And I would totally support, to tag on to what you said before, I would totally go for an Oscar too.
So before we get into our reviews, I want to ask, who is your favorite character in this movie? Like, what is your favorite performance? Who is your favorite character? Because there's so many. Like, which is the one that really think nails it all together for you?
This one would have to be a tie. I mean, Tim Curry does, he steals the show. His one-liners, I think, those were my belly laughs when it comes to any of his given lines. Whenever he's talking to Snap Slugs, there's not a line that he doesn't deliver, where he talks to Connie towards the end, where he talks about his dialect and he goes to check his zipper. I mean, he's just gold. But Aldo, there's a special place in my heart for Aldo, where he just has almost that kind of still tough guy, but that innocence, but he has a likability on screen that anytime he appears, you just kind of want to smile because he is that supporting role. He's almost like a bridge between Stallone and all the other goofy characters. And I think he plays that off really well. And I think he plays to his strength when it comes to the performance.
Right. He's like the dog in Up. Was it Doug? He's just got that lovable ignorance to him that makes that character so well. And Paul Mattery, being such a tough guy, plays it so great. For me, it's the Fanucci brothers. The fact that they're pretty much in the lobby of this house the entire time with this suit. And the fact that it is Martin Ferreira and Harry Shearer playing these roles. These guys are so good at it. They almost have like a Coen brother-esque energy to them, right? Their banter, their dialogue, their accents, their dialect, the fact that they keep popping in and out and in and out, it's just a treat. This movie is a treat, and those guys are like my favorite parts of it. Every time they show up, I feel it's the injection of energy that the movie needs to kind of keep us going and not wear ourselves down for whatever's going to happen next. Because there are some sluggish moments where, like, the problem with madcap comedy, right, is when it slows down, it dies. So they always have to have these perfectly timed rhythmic injections of comedic energy to keep it going. And they kind of mentioned that in the review. So how about we go ahead and listen to the first part of this? Siskel leads it off.
First film is Oscar, and this comedy accomplishes something few films do, and that is makes a very funny comeback after a nearly disastrous opening 20 minutes. We go to see a lot of pictures, and if it doesn't work in the first reel, they don't save themselves. This one, I think, does. Sylvester Stallone stars as a Depression-era mobster named Snaps Provolone.
So he nailed it right on the head. Like, the opening scene of this movie, I think it's supposed to be the grabber, right? It's got the best cameo of the movie. You've got Kirk Douglas playing his dad. There's a lot of physical comedy, a lot of slapstick, but the energy just is a little bit off. There's a little bit too much ham and cheese in this opening scene. Like you said, as Stallone is kind of getting his feet wet into this character and really learning how to play it, it's a little bit wooden, it's a little bit forced, and there is an uneasiness. And as I rewatched this, I was like, ooh, I get what they're saying. This isn't as funny as it wants to be, which is why when it does get funnier later, it totally makes up for it. But I get what he's saying here. The first 20 minutes is a little bit rough, and there's a lot of movies like that, but they're usually not comedies. They're usually dramas, or they're usually action films, right?
Yeah, well, to me, I see it, but I have a different outlook on it. Is to me, the opening scene is, how would you start? How would you have this gangster go straight? How are you going to set up this movie? I mean, this is a dying father on a bed. Obviously, it's not going to be the happiest, funniest moment of the movie, and it can't be, because there has to be a level of stakes. There has to be an introduction to a conflict. So to me, I didn't mind the intro so bad, to the point where he's in that room for maybe 5 minutes, and to kind of base a movie based on the first 5 minutes of just an introduction to the conflict. What I do respect about it, even though it is a little bit harsh, there are some things I would change with it. But what I would say is they could have toned back the physical violence a little bit. And if you're going to be serious on it, be serious on it. I'd actually rather have them go that route. That way, the comedy has a bigger impact when it happens. It kind of takes the audience more by surprise instead of just going from cringy to comedy. It goes from serious to skyrocket to this chaotic comedy. So to me, I'm back and forth, but I didn't mind it so much because, one, I think Kirk Douglas does in his 20 lines that he has, if that, does a good job. It's a pleasure seeing Kirk Douglas smack the shit out of Stallone. But, you know, it was an okay opening for me.
I think my biggest issue with it is that when we look at how well the film is spliced together in the second two acts, how well the editing is and how well the energy is kept up, there's something about that opening scene and even like the introductory scene of Snaps going straight and you get introduced to the characters that work for him and are in and out of his house. There is a weird pacing. There's weird editing there. And I don't know if that is like studios trying to fix it, trying to make it more coherent. I don't know, but it pulls itself back together. So I'm not even saying that it's a performance issue as much as I think what he's trying to say is that there is an energy issue. There is a structure issue that just doesn't feel right. It almost feels like they're tuning up their instruments before they play their orchestra. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can see that. And again, I think we talked about the music earlier. So the music doesn't help support this stale tone. I think that would be my biggest nitpick on it, is leave the music out. We don't need the stereotypical Italian funeral music going on in the background, because that's really going to slow down the pace. And I've said it before, is music is everything when it sets the pace and the tone to support the characters. And I think that's kind of where we get that real staleness, because I did have a problem with after the father meeting, where it does take a little bit to, like you said, the great example of tuning the instruments, because that it does feel like that a little bit until everybody gets their feet wet.
Yeah, like once you get all the characters in play and interacting with each other, just the little one-offs leading up to all of that, they don't seem complete. And again, that's where it's like, if you go in with a cinematic mind, it might bother you. But if you just go in trying to enjoy it, you'd probably have a much better time with it. That's why I have a hard time sometimes. I'm like, oh, it's like when we go see a musical or something and like there's one note that's off and we let it affect us for like the next 10 minutes until everyone's back in key and back into the energy again. I feel it's a little bit of that. They keep going here.
Oscar is a funny throwback to the tightly written, lickety-split comedies of the 30s, and it is very funny at times. It's a pleasure to encounter a script and a storyline that has been really well thought out. This is based on a French play and a movie, and the adaptation is terrific. Stallone is just okay, I think, as the lead, but it's the supporting cast, all these crazies that are constantly walking in and out, that really recommend Oscar.
So, yeah, agree with him 100%. And like we already said, it doesn't matter who the lead is. It doesn't matter if they're just okay because they're the anchor. And it is all the characters. And the time they probably spent auditioning and casting these people and reaching into their pocket of like, who do you know? Who do we remember? You know, there's a lot of Animal House guys in here. You know, there's a lot of industry standards in this movie that really make it what it is. So the question is, does the common audience respect that and recognize that, you know, or are they just really just seeing what Stallone has? I feel like a lot of the pressure on this movie really fell on Stallone. And when he's just giving an okay performance, then the expectations of the movie just become okay.
You said it right there, is the expectations, because even Gene says it in his review just now, is Stallone's just okay. I mean, when you see Stallone in a movie like this, you are going to go in with a certain expectation. It's going to be Stallone out of his element, but you're still going to hold him to a standard of watching the likability of Stallone on screen. So there is a certain expectation viewers have. And again, that could lead into the downfall of this movie in the box office. But that's the one thing I think drove me a little bit nuts with Gene's review, is he had to take that final shot at Stallone, where it's not really necessary because he even acknowledges that it doesn't make the movie. It's a supporting cast, and to take out the anchor, the stern character that kind of is there for the supporting cast, I think it's almost an unfair measure to it. But I can kind of see where he's going with the common moviegoer of people going to see Stallone there. So I do appreciate that he acknowledges it, but at the same time, I think it's an unfair measurement.
I agree with you on that, because if there's one thing that we've discussed on this show more than anything, is that Gene does not always remain consistent with who is he speaking for in terms of the critique. Like, there's some times where he wants to speak in the terms of an intellectual, where he wants to really turn on his film nerd hat, you know, his avant-garde cinema hat. But then there's times where he wants to defend just like the common man and their enjoyment at the movies. Is they're worth their money? That is one of my biggest issues with his critiques, is that he doesn't really play from a level ground. It depends on where he's feeling or what part of his brain the film tickled of how he's going to approach this review. To me, this is something that I could see so many other movies that he's watched that were like this that he totally tore apart. And it makes me wonder, what was it about this film that made him be so straightforward and honest about his opinion of liking it? It still kind of boggles me where that line is crossed, right?
Yeah, and well, we can listen to the passion that Gene has and how he liked this movie, how he enjoyed this movie. This is a fun movie. It's a funny movie, subtly funny movie. But when we put in elements of things that just kind of contradict that feeling of speaking to whoever's watching his review, of saying, well, this kind of I didn't like because he kind of sucked the fun out of it, we're trying to sell this comedy. We're trying to convince people that this is worth your time, this is worth your money. And when you add that but to somebody that's going to have a majority of the screen time, that kind of takes away from what your critique is trying to tell the viewer.
Right. 100%. Now, Roger has his say.
You know, you put your finger right on it. This movie started slowly. I am not a fan of comedies about gangsters set in the early 30s with all of the running boards on the cars and the fedora hats and everything. This stuff has been done so often, I'm sitting there thinking, boy, this is really a dog, you know. And then I laughed, and then I laughed again. Then the Fennucci brothers came I really started laughing. And then when Tim Curry comes in as that Dr. Poole, the elocution coach, I was laughing. And then at the end of the movie, I sat there and I said, I don't know how this movie did it, but it did just what you said it did. It turned itself around. It's a good movie. It's a funny movie. It really is.
It doesn't happen very often, and I don't think it was set up to turn itself around. I think the comedy was very bad with the Kirk Douglas slapping Stallone and all this sort of stuff. Doesn't work at all. Stallone, I think, doesn't have the best...
Stallone's character has to be the center of things in a way. Stallone has to kind of stand there and be the straight man, and they just keep throwing one character after another at him. It's a thankless role, I think he does just fine.
Well, except that when he runs up the stairs, like he runs too fast. He doesn't run like a mobster; he runs like Rocky Balboa. I think that's a mistake.
Let him do it. That's okay.
Again, Gene does typical Gene, where Roger retorts with a very astute observation and a very astute opinion about the film and why it worked. And then Gene has to throw some kind of hackneyed, oh, well, but when he runs up the stairs, he runs too fast. He runs like Rocky. Okay, is that your basis of why Stallone's performance doesn't work for you? Because he runs too fast up the stairs? Like, this is so typical them. Even when they agree with each other, they have to find a way to, like, create enough of that animosity towards something. Like, Gene cannot stand liking something as much as Roger does. And then Roger, when he's a lot more eloquent with the reasons why and sounds like a better critic and a better reviewer, Gene falls back into like this survival mode, right? Where he just starts picking things out of the movie that he's got an issue with. And that is like his new hill to die on. He could have just agreed with Roger and like, yes, you're right. But no, he had to throw something completely asinine out there.
This is one of my favorite reviews that I've watched, because it's like kids arguing, because you have Roger that is super, you can hear it. He's excited in his review. He's excited in this movie. He goes, and then I liked, and then I liked, and then I liked, and then I liked. And then you just hear this giddiness, childlike love for this movie on how great it is. And it's almost like a jealousy piece of it, where Roger's talking all this positive, but then Gene is going, he's doubling down on the Stallone.
Yeah.
And he has to put in the piece where, well, wait, I want you to say a negative. I want you to say something bad about Stallone. And Roger is within his right and says, let him run up the stairs like Rocky, because it doesn't affect the movie. I mean, how many people would I question who've seen this movie that would have the conversation of, did you see how Stallone ran up those stairs? Nobody cares.
No one cares.
Because it's the whole movie isn't surrounded around a 2.5 second running up the stairs piece of it. But that's just that one final jab to try and convince Roger to say something bad about the Stallone performance or pick a negative out of this movie. And I love the fact that Ebert stuck to his guns with it.
Yeah, agreed 100%. And they both like it. They both give it a thumbs up. You know, that's, I'm not going to say it's a rarity for them, but for a film like this, I think it is a rarity. Number one, a Stallone film. And number two, Roger was very eloquent about how he does have reservations about 1930s gangster comedies. And honestly, so do I. There's very few that I actually think work. Johnny Dangerously, I think, is one that works. Clue is one that kind of works if you're talking about like period slapstick comedy. This one. But I mean, you can just get on any streaming service right now and look at all of just the gangster comedies of like the 70s and early 80s starring sitcom stars that are just terrible. It's not a well-proven formula or genre. So that, again, that's what makes this film even more surprising to me that it's as good as it is. But the fact that these two guys liked it, when they probably went in going, oh God, another gangster movie from the 30s, and it turned them around. It's a special thing.
Well, and it's a special thing, and it's a surprising thing, because when you take a movie like this that just kind of takes us by surprise, and this is between both of them, and I'll even give Gene a little bit of credit here, is this is a movie that I didn't remember the review personally. I had to go back after I watched it to see what they actually gave it, because I couldn't remember when we discussed putting this movie on. Mm-hmm. And I was actually surprised that they both actually liked it. I vaguely remember the review. So that was a pleasant surprise. But how excited they got discussing this movie is also a double treat to it, because for me, when I love a movie as much as I love this movie, to see somebody, critics, the rare critics at this time that actually did enjoy this movie, and the most important at that time, that one should have kind of almost helped push this movie, because the theory was Siskel and Ebert liked it. We see a little bit of box office success from it. But this isn't the case with it. But this, when it comes to how they discuss it and how giddy, this is the rare moments between these two that we rarely get, because it's a great movie and it's one of those crowd pleasers if people just gave it a chance.
Yeah, it makes me think of, like, if it's just a generational thing, like maybe people who had expectations of what a Stallone movie should be back in the early 90s, that they already had it set in their mind of what they want their Stallone movies to be like, and it wasn't this. You know, a lot of people were really hesitant about wanting to like Arnold Schwarzenegger in a comedic film, and then Twins came and that changed everything. You know, it's like, oh, Arnold doesn't just have to be the Terminator or the Predator guy. Like, he can spread his wings. This is my hot topic debate question for you. Who do you think handles comedy better, Schwarzenegger or Stallone?
It all depends on the written. I would say Schwarzenegger, he has one gimmick going for him, and that's showing anger in a line. So whenever we see something shine comedically from Schwarzenegger, it's when he's shouting or he's frustrated or he's angry. What I appreciate about Stallone is he's kind of well-rounded. He knows how to take that subtle dialogue and make it appear funny. It's almost like a borderline sarcastic delivery. Mm-hmm. But I think they both of them have two different styles, but I'd have to say Stallone handles it a little bit more natural, because you put a script in front of Schwarzenegger, he's not going to be able to deliver comedy without shouting his lines.
I agree with that. I say Stallone too, but the caveat is I think Stallone's always funnier when it's his own dialogue. You know, like in the Rocky movies, he's legit funny because he's really just kind of being himself. He's always had a challenge when he's doing other people's materials, and I think that is why he's got that sour reputation of always taking over projects and taking over scripts and rewriting them, because he's a really good writer, and I think he understands how to write for himself. So this is a film that you probably couldn't do that on. You know, he's not going to be able to write a 30s gangster comedy. I mean, he kind of co-wrote Cotton Club, and that didn't work out too great, you know? So I agree with that, where Stallone handles it better. I think Schwarzenegger's in funnier movies, but they're not necessarily funnier because he's in them. They're just pretty funny movies on their own, and throw an Austrian bodybuilder in the mix, and it can make for another funny addition to it. But I think genuinely Stallone handles comedy better. I agree.
You take a Schwarzenegger, I mean, you can tell that most of these scripts were written almost for him. You have Twins opposite Danny DeVito. You have a big tough cop playing a kindergarten teacher. So a lot of these situational comedies are designed for Schwarzenegger versus Stallone. Like, we take Oscar, Jim Belushi was originally scheduled to play him.
Yeah.
And we take now Stallone. So it's a more versatile kind of style that Stallone has, and he adjusts fairly well to it.
Okay, so now it's time to grade our critics here. And, you know, he's been kind of on a good streak lately. Gene handles this pretty well. I'm not a huge fan of his jabs at the end at Stallone. I agree with you 100% on that one. But starting off, he doesn't really shy away from saying how much he liked this movie. He's very raw and open about how he had, you know, second thoughts of how it started and how it kind of won him back. That kind of sincerity and openness and humility is something we see very little of from this guy. So I'm going to give him a B- on this one.
Nice. One thing I appreciate about Ebert is, if you're trying to convince a viewer to go see, spend money on a ticket, this is the pivotal moment of how you portray that to the viewer. He speaks with passion. He's giddy. He has an excitement in his tone. He's convincing the audience. He uses the and then. I love that passion radiating from his review. And he sticks to his guns. He doesn't really give any negatives. I mean, this is a feel-good comedy. His review makes you feel good. He really convinces me that this is a movie that I would have a good time with. So this is probably going to be the highest I do Ebert so far, but I'll go 3.5 on Ebert.
Yeah, that's high for you. Yeah, I agree. That's a great review. I love that he sticks to his guns. And it's okay to root for the underdog sometimes. Like, I don't think he or Gene are expecting to enjoy Stallone in a comedic role. But recognizing that it didn't have to be Stallone and that the movie works goes back to my point where sometimes I get frustrated with Gene a lot, where we have to stop judging the entire project based on how you feel about a certain star or director or writer, right? Like, leaving that bias at the door and just allowing yourself to let the movie do what it's trying to do. We saw that in The Frighteners, man. That's probably one of my most disappointing aspects of that, is that he's so disappointed in Michael J. Fox for doing whatever he thinks he did to his career with that movie, that he completely just washed over any of the beneficial things that could have been said about that movie just because of his bias towards a guy he liked in a movie he didn't like. So being able to kind of step back from that for this review is why I gave him a higher score.
Yeah, and you don't want to judge a painter by the first paint stroke. So you have to see the ending results. So setting the expectation and basing how the movie's going to play out with that certain expectation with the first paint stroke, it's just unfair to the filmmaker. It's unfair to the cast. It's unfair to anybody involved. You got to give it a chance to the final result. And in this case, the result just works.
Yeah, 100%. So everyone, I say that this is a movie that you just have to find and see. Now, lucky for most of us, it's on YouTube in a pretty decent quality right now. So if you don't have a physical copy and you don't want to spend like the $5 it is to rent on these other sites, YouTube's got a pretty good copy. I just say go and watch it. You've already heard us say that the first couple minutes might be a little bit rough, but it really makes up for it in the second and third acts. I even say halfway through the first act. Once all the characters are into play, it doesn't stop. It doesn't stop for air, and that's what makes it so enjoyable and an underrated comedy classic of the 90s and an underrated Stallone film. Like, no one ever talks about this movie in his catalog, and they should.
Totally forgotten, and it needs to resurface because, again, we don't get a lot of comedies nowadays in theaters. We get some crappy comedies on streaming. This is a rarity that I really hope just comes back to the surface and people really do enjoy and have some fun with, because it is, again, an incredibly entertaining and fun movie.
So everyone, those are our reviews on Oscar from 1991. Next week, we're going to be talking about 1986's The Name of the Rose, directed by Jean-Jacques Annaud, starring Sean Connery, Christian Slater, Ron Perlman, and a bevy of recognizable faces in a very, very interesting, I'm going to say, ahead of its time film when it comes to its vibe, its tone, and the atmospheric quality it creates for the 80s. And it's just a real interesting film that we haven't really tackled something this dark yet on the show. So I'm really excited to see what we think about that one.
That will be an interesting conversation. I cannot wait to revisit this one.
All right, everyone. So you know where to find us. I'm Antonio, host of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast. You can find me at thecultworthy.com. My co-host, Justin.
You can find me at themoviewire.com and anywhere you listen to your podcasts.
Make sure you follow us both on Letterboxd if you want to see our final scores on what we rated the films that we review. We don't talk about those on the show. Check out our Letterboxd, and you might even find some spoilers and some hints about what's coming up soon. So once again, Justin, great talking to you. I can't wait to talk about this next week on Back to the Balcony.
See you next week.